record, Kathy Gowdy, 28436, alternate defense counsel for Mr. Samuel Lincoln. And first, I want to thank this panel for having rescheduled the arguments. Vail Pass was closed off and on, and it didn't seem worth the danger. So thank you very much. And for staying late. The first issue in this case, and probably one of the most strong ones, was the discovery violation and whether or not it prejudiced Mr. Lincoln's case to the point that a new trial is merited. The discovery violation was when the advisory witness who had sat through the trial had heard the experts of the defendants talk about all the various things that had not happened or that this detective had blocked CBI from doing, got up on the stand and said he had had phone calls that were not recorded in either CBI's reports or in his report, in which CBI said, we don't think this needs to be done. It's just not, doesn't need to be done. Filed with them a supplement to the motion for new trial were detailed affidavits, including interviews of CBI stating that they document at a scene. If a phone call is made, even if the Glenwood Springs police don't document it because you can't write every single thing down, CBI does. These calls did not exist in the CBI records. And there were several that Detective Hassel talked to. So clearly we're looking at a case here where perhaps there is perjury by the detective in his rebuttal testimony. The district attorney knew what the testimony was going to be because the district attorney knew what questions to ask him. She didn't put him on the stand and say, you've heard this testimony. What's wrong with it? It wasn't a free flow of information. The question was, do you do reports? What about that call? What about blood spots? She had discussed it with him. She knew it was contrary to everything in evidence. She knew that it was contrary to anything that had been testified to in the earlier trial. And yet it was put on the stand. And the point of it was to disparage the presentation of the defense that the experts had said this was not a good investigation, and in fact, exculpatory evidence was not explored. They did not test the budget hotel.
But didn't this evidence just explain why they didn't do it? The jury could still draw the inference that the defense experts testified that this should have been done. They could still draw the inference that it should have been done.
They could. The jury's questions did go directly into the factors of should this have been done? Could this have been done? Would there have been extra charges for it? All of the answers were no. This is what CBI does. That CBI was restricting what it was to doing. And I think part of the confusion in it was that he just got up and said, well, we don't do everything. Remember these phone calls? Okay. But it mixed in the exculpatory evidence that they also, the Glenwood Springs police, did not do, which was they knew what room in the hotel was within 10 days. They did not send in anyone to do blood expert test. The testimony of that witness in this particular trial was unequivocal, that they came in covered with blood. There was blood everywhere. And the testimony of the defense's experts was that if blood had gone in that hotel room, it was testable within 10 days. They could have found that. If there wasn't blood in that hotel room, it would have been exculpatory to Mr. Lincoln. And so the purpose of the investigation and the flaws in the investigation was to show that they were focused just on picking Mr. Lincoln. For the defendant, they were not investigating, and it rose to a level that it was a violation of his right to exculpatory evidence. There's no way, when the charges were finally brought to trial, for the defendant to go and test that hotel room. Years had passed. No way. So it had been destroyed. There was no other way. It was easily within the police's hands. And the fact that the police knew they could test for it was that 8 months afterwards, they went in and pounded Mr. Lincoln's Mustang, tested it for the blood that the same witness claimed was in there, and then said, there is no trace of blood in this car. That's exculpatory. And in fact, the judge found that that was one of the factors in the motion for a new trial, found it was a particularly weak case. So we have a district attorney putting on a testimony that she knows is untrue, and it's there simply to eviscerate the defense. And there isn't a sur rebuttal or a right to bring in your expert back in a trial. This was, he went on as rebuttal after he had tested in the direct. There were affidavits provided showing that it was perjury because the CBI people even said they would have documented such calls if these calls had occurred.
Ms. Gowdy, what did the trial court on the new trial motion rule as to the falsity of the statement?
He didn't. I don't believe. I believe what he just said is it went to the credibility of the jury and he wouldn't do it. He didn't believe it, eviscerated it. I guess he did, to something on the credibility. He did not believe it, eviscerated it, that the difference was the credibility of the witness between the two trials. And that would be Sharon, because at the time of the first trial, she was still using meth. At the time of the second trial, she was in rehab and far more coherent. So he found that it did not did not affect the credibility.
Okay. So if I'm understanding correctly, the trial judge did not make any finding as to the police officer, whether he was being truthful or not in testifying with his conversation with CBI?
No, I think what he, I don't, I think what he ruled was that it did not eviscerate the defense and that it was weight, not credibility. I believe that's what it was.
Okay, so there was no finding on whether that testimony was false or not?
No, there was not a ruling on that. Though it was raised in the motions, in the written motions filed after the trial. All right. Secondly, on the discovery issues, let me see. Secondly, was the allowing of the hearsay testimony by Mr. Mortensen that he said that Sam and, gosh, I'm losing my mind, I'm sorry. Sam and so-and-so were coming to the hotel room. And it was allowed as the admission of a party opponent. It was allowed as the admission of a co-conspirator. Over objection and over objection. It's clearly hearsay. The witness herself, when she was put on the stand, said she never said it. It was not done in furtherance of a conspiracy. The admission of it was totally impermissible because no conspiracy had been established. Colorado precedent is very clear on that, that you have to establish the conspiracy, and all they put on was the injuries, the crime itself, and then they put on Mr. Mortensen that said he had talked to this one woman and she said this. And then she denies it. It was not even tied up together. All of this was objected to strenuously. Why it is especially important that this is reversible is this became the linchpin then for the prosecution's argument. She stated, Sam, I'm blanking on the second name, I'm sorry. Lawrence Doty. She said, Sam and Larry are coming. And that's the only place I came in was through Mr. Mortensen. However, not only being hearsay, it became what was the soul of the argument. Sam and Larry, or Doty and Lincoln, which was never even said or testified to. There was a very weak case against Mr. Lincoln. He had exculpatory evidence about the blood in the car. There was a lack of investigation, and yet that statement coming in seemed to establish not only conspiracy, but then they allowed the complicity instruction. And I'm going to move to the complicity instruction because it was improper in the way it was put forward. If you are going to be complicit, not the principal, but the complicitor in someone else's criminal act, it is an absolutely relevant fact for the jury to know that the principal was acquitted. And in fact, I believe it's established black letter law and accessory law that if the principal is acquitted, you can't bring the accessory charges anymore.
What case are you relying on?
I think it's in the...
I think the law is the contrary.
I thought you can't be an accessory unless the principal's committed the crime. If there was no crime, you can't accessorize it. It's in the... I don't have that in my brief. It came to me in another moment of inspiration, but this one I believe is correct, and I don't believe it's contrary. The reason that this is unfair to give it is because then the jury is given a second bite at the apple between conspiracy and complicity without being given the full set of facts. It's relevant that Doty was acquitted. It's relevant that he was found not guilty because he was the principal. In all of the testimony, he was the one that was supposedly the aggressor, the more active, the one that was sleeping with the witness, the one that had visited on several occasions. There was testimony from the doorman at the hotel that he'd seen this man's explorer there before. And yet there was no investigations whether the explorer had blood in it or any of that kind of thing. And yet the fact that would help the defendant, that another jury had heard these same people and he was acquitted, it was not offered because another jury had done it and they should do the same. In fact, it was a very, it's a strategic decision on that one, because the jury may be so offended by the facts, they would say, well, Doty got away with it, but you're not. So it's a strategic decision. It's not just a necessary fact, but it is important, because you shouldn't be given complicity if the principal's been acquitted. It just makes no sense. It's illogical. It flaws. Overall, this case involves a lot of issues. Overall, the motion for judgment acquittal should have been granted. It was, the judge reserved that and said no because of the difference in the appearance of the witness and the existence of the Mustang. And yet the Mustang had been tested and found to have no blood in it. So it was an exculpatory. It makes no sense. The motion for judgment of acquittal should have been granted. At that time, the complicity instruction should not have been given unless they allowed it to be put in. No offer of proof was needed to be made that there had been an acquittal of Mr. Doty. That for one thing, I believe it was the same judge. It was a different judge sat on the trial. But it was the same district attorney. Hypothetically speaking, the defense attorney probably had a certified copy of the jury verdicts ready to go. There's no issue whatsoever that there was an acquittal. A proffer is not necessary. But it did go to the fundamental fairness, because we give the jury instructions so they understand the law. They can only do the law as they're given. If you give them a complicity instruction, it infers that this person can be responsible for it because the principal was. And in this case, they needed to know that the principal was not. If there are no questions, I would reserve my time for rebuttal.
I have about 3 minutes.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I'm Jennifer Berman, and I represent the prosecution in this matter. I'm going to first discuss the discovery issue, but I would like to point out on the complicity issue, defense counsel had stated that if the principal is acquitted, then you cannot convict the accessory. I would like to direct this court's attention to the statute 18-1-605 for complicity evidence, that it's no defense that the principal was not charged or that the principal was not convicted, that you may still convict the complicitor. Going to the discovery issue, defense counsel makes this issue much broader than it actually is. It's actually a very narrow issue that was presented for the motion for a new trial, and that is whether Detective Hassell's testimony in rebuttal, in which he said, I had two phone conversations with the regional director of CBI, and together we agreed not to process blood stains found at the crime scene, whether that testimony, the information in that testimony, should have been disclosed to the defense beforehand. And it was not disclosed. It was not part of his written report. And it was simply an oral statement that was not memorialized. As the court pointed out, it simply dealt with how the detective came to the conclusion not to pursue one avenue of investigation. And that's not the kind of thing that needs to be disclosed in discovery. It's not exculpatory and it's not material. So the prosecutor had no duty to disclose this evidence because it was not a statement of a witness. It further had no duty to disclose this information because it was not exculpatory nor material. In fact, defense counsel in the opening brief, and I feel a bit in the argument as well, points out just how damaging the detective's statements on rebuttal were, how much they undermined the defense. Well, that's not exculpatory. That's inculpatory. If it impeached the credibility of the defense's two defense experts, well, that damages the defendant's case. It doesn't help it. And there was no obligation for the prosecutor to turn over that evidence. Now, the issue on the statements allegedly being false, I don't think that's been shown by the record. With the motion for a new trial, the defense presented two affidavits of the defense experts who testified, and I think they went into discussing the procedures of CBI and how they document things and whether they charge the law enforcement agencies that use them and things to this effect. And I don't think that in any way showed that the detective's statement that he had two conversations with the regional director of CBI and the content of those statements, that that showed in any way that that was false testimony.
It says there's no record at the CBI that those calls were made. Is that a correct statement of the record as you understand it?
I do seem to recall one of the affidavits of the defense expert stating that. What's interesting, though, is that I think in the reply for the motion for a new trial, an affidavit of a defense investigator is presented. And that investigator spoke with the regional director of CBI, and the regional director of CBI said he did remember some conversations like that. And while he would normally memorialize something of significant substance, he didn't memorialize this. And I think that's because it's not of significant substance necessarily. I mean, this is simply discussing the investigative avenue they were going to take and why they were taking it. And more so, I would like to point out that even if this testimony were false, and I'm by no means conceding that it is, the defense would have to prove that the prosecutor knowingly presented false testimony, and there's nothing in the record to support that. There's nothing in the record to support that the prosecutor knew or should have known whether the detective, in fact, had these phone conversations with the regional director. And so for that reason also, the trial court properly denied the motion for a new trial. There was no duty to disclose the evidence, and it did not concern false testimony that the prosecutor knowingly presented. If there are no more questions on that issue, I'd like to go to the co-conspirator statements. Excuse me. Here the trial court admitted statements of Sharon Coelho, however you would pronounce that, leading to Nick Mortensen, who was an eyewitness, who saw the defendant, or he saw three men arrive at Ms. Coelho's hotel room in order to plan for this robbery. And the statements that Nick Mortensen presented first were that Sharon Coelho asked him, "Do you want in on a robbery? We're going to rob a maintenance worker named Fred." Interestingly, the defense did not object to that statement. And then when the prosecutor asked Mortensen, "Did she tell you the names of her friends who were coming over?" I'm sorry, she had also said, "I have some friends coming over to help me plan this." And when the prosecutor asked, "Did she give you the names?" that's when you get an objection. And the trial court eventually found that those statements were admissible as admissions by a co-conspirator, because it found that the statements were made during the course of and in furtherance of a conspiracy.
So what did the court rely on to say that there was a conspiracy to justify its admission of those statements?
The court actually relied, it took judicial notice of the co-defendant's case, Larry Doty's case, and it found that from the evidence presented in that case, that there was a conspiracy. But I think more appropriately, the court should have just relied on the statements themselves, which the court can rely on in determining whether the statements come in, because it doesn't have to rely on the rules of evidence. It can look simply at the statements themselves, and if they are later corroborated by evidence by the close of trial, then they can be appropriately brought in. And here, the statements themselves demonstrated that it was during the course of a conspiracy, because Sharon Coelho invited Mortensen to join in robbing the victim. She was trying to recruit more participants into the conspiracy, and that shows that it was during the course of, and it was also in furtherance of.
It's not evidence of a conspiracy, is it? I mean, it's just her statement that
I think it is evidence.
Joe and Bob are going to help me do this robbery. And that's evidence of a conspiracy between she and Joe and Bob, and I realize I'm changing the names, but you know what I mean.
Right. I absolutely think it's evidence of the conspiracy between her, Sam Lincoln, and Larry Doty to go rob the victim at his home. And she recruited someone else in to do that very same thing, and she told him, this is what we're going to do. Do you want in? I think that's evidence of the conspiracy. And it was corroborated by evidence at trial in which she herself identified the defendant as one of the people who came over to plan the robbery and execute it.
Not suggesting it's appropriate the court took judicial notice of the other trial.
I'm not.
Okay, Ms. Berman, help me figure this out then. If there needs to be a condition precedent to admitting the evidence, which is the court finding there's a conspiracy, then a court may consider the statement itself as evidence, but also needs to consider corroborating evidence. You stated that it's enough that corroborating evidence comes in later. And I guess I'm a little bit confused on this if you need a condition precedent to admitting the evidence, but then we're relying on something later. So can you help
me figure this out? I think it's that for the, I would present it that for the trial court itself, you know, it's not held by the rules of evidence in making this determination at that point. It simply needs to find by a preponderance of the evidence that the conspiracy existed, that the defendant and the declarant were part of that conspiracy. And therefore, it can look to the statements themselves. By the end of trial, for the reviewing court, it needs corroborating evidence to make sure that the trial court appropriately admitted that evidence. And you can see that from the case, if I can find it. That's discussed in People versus James at 40 P3rd 36, in which it says the trial court may determine the admissibility based solely on the statements itself, but there must be independent evidence by the end of trial to corroborate it.
Did James rely on the rules of evidence 104 to come to that conclusion? Was it discussing a reviewing court versus the trial court, or was it discussing the trial court?
I don't know that it went into that specifically, but James does itself say that the trial court does not need to rely on the rules of evidence, and therefore it may make this determination based on the statements themselves. So my reading of that is that it's more to advise the reviewing court that you need to have corroborating evidence by the end of trial to make sure that the statements were correctly admitted. As to the final issue discussed, whether the complicity instruction was properly admitted, I would first like to point out that the issue of whether the instruction was properly admitted and whether evidence of Larry Doty's acquittal was properly excluded are completely separate issues that have nothing to do with each other, and one will not affect the other. The fact that Larry Doty was acquitted at his own trial and whether that evidence should come in has nothing to do with whether there was some evidence to support a complicity instruction, that being that two or more people jointly engaged in committing the crime, which here the evidence very clearly shows. With the exclusion of that evidence, there's no indication in the record as to how that would be relevant. And I don't think that defense counsel has discussed why it would be relevant. It just simply isn't. Just the same as a co-defendant's guilty plea is not relevant for the substance of the to determine the defendant's guilt. A co-defendant's acquittal is not relevant to determine whether he's guilty or not. And here you're looking at someone who was tried at a separate trial where there was separate evidence, and we have a little bit of discussion of that in the record because evidence of the defendant's Mustang, which both Nick Mortensen and Sharon Coelho testified he showed up in at her hotel before committing the crime. Evidence of his Mustang was not presented, apparently, at Larry Doty's trial. And that was pretty damning evidence against the defendant as to his ID, as to him being one of the perpetrators. And furthermore, you just have a completely different jury. That jury may have acquitted Larry Doty based on sympathy or based on confusion as to the issues. We don't know. But it's just not relevant in the defendant's own case. If this court has no more questions, I would ask that you affirm the defendant's convictions. Thank you.
To address the question as to whether or not the district court ruled on the truth or falsity of the rebuttal testimony, it did not. I checked the transcript of 5708 when the oral ruling was made, and it did not go the truth or falsity. It went to the weight and the credence of the jury and the factors of that. Regarding the issue of compliciter, the case cited in my brief, is this my first brief or my reply brief? My opening brief, Brito v. People, states there must be sufficient evidence presented to show there was in fact a principal who was guilty of the crime charged in an accessory case. The elements in fact of complicity require that a principal committed a crime and that the secondary, that's not the word in the statute, but seems to be the only one that makes sense, the secondary person knew of the crime and were aware of it and didn't stop it. So you have to have some guilt. So it is relevant to the issue as to whether or not the principal's guilt if you are putting in an instruction of complicity. If the instruction of complicity did not get used, then my argument would not be so strong. But by putting in the complicity instruction, it made absolutely relevant what is the guilt or innocence or the not guilty knowledge of the principal in this matter, and that was Larry Doty. Secondly, the evidence that was not disclosed by the people differs from the cases cited by the people in their brief in that I believe the first disclosure of it was when it was remembered in the courtroom as the experts testified and the detective sat there. The disclosure occurred on the stand in front of the jury and stating, oh, there's no reports of this, I'm just remembering it now. It is different because there was no advance notice, there was no opportunity to rebut, it just came out. The standard of Brady is not merely exculpatory or material, but any evidence that is favorable to the defense. And calls to CBI, where allegedly CBI is saying, by our joint decision, we're not going to do these blood tests, are helpful to the defense, particularly when it was opened through all of the motions hearing process, that the defense was there was no investigation here except to point the finger at Sam Lincoln and convict him.
Well, counsel, it seems to me that your experts or the defendant's experts testified that the investigation was deficient because they failed to do some things.
Yes.
Is that correct? And now the prosecution puts on evidence that says, we not only failed to do it, we consciously considered it and decided not to do it. Doesn't that sort of bolster the defense rather than hurt the defense?
No, because the statement is that CBI said there would be a time delay, and they didn't really seem eager to come and do it, and so I relied on CBI, and it was a joint decision to me with CBI to not do this investigation. That's not the same thing as ours, what the defendant was saying. That's saying CBI said, oh, we shouldn't do it, and they didn't. I see my time is up. Are there any further questions?
Thank you very much.
We
thank both counsel for the briefs and arguments. The case will be deemed submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course.